Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Jeff Show. And we're a classy show, Rick. We're not just an ordinary show.
We're a self-proclaimed classy show.
We are classy indeed. We do not spell Jeff with a J. No, our Jeff Show, dedicated
has lots of letters in it.
Dedicated to Canadian listener Jeff, is spelled G-off. This is the G-off Show. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. My co-host, my co-medical host, Shelley Irving, is on assignment in Isonville. But here, UK Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure. Oh, wait a minute. UK Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure. Sorry, this was an old template.
You're quite prepared today.
But here to talk and allow me a time to recover, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know, you can get the audio of the show at the Moorhead State Public Radio website, WMKY.org. You'll find Health Matters in the menus. Jump over to the page. You'll see a list of the recent shows. Look at the summaries. But most importantly, there's a link there where you can get the audio. So say you missed a show or you caught part of it or, you know, you're listening to this part, but you know you got to go into the store or do this or do something and you want to just get back to it. You can do that. WMKY.org. You can find all the most recent shows. Maybe you liked it. Maybe you wanted to hear more. Maybe you're just intrigued with what we could possibly say next. And either way, go there. You'll get the audio. Listen to them. Give them to your friends. Christmas is coming. These make perfect gifts. They're the greatest stocking stuffers you can not have to buy. Isn't that right, Tony?
I always heard that a foot was the best stocking stuffer.
Yeah, well, if you wear stockings, Tony. True. Do you wear stockings?
Man, you really aim low. Just a one missed introduction, and all of a sudden we're in deep trouble here.
Hey, I'm interim. That's it. You've taken my job away. But nonetheless, so now we've listened to the show. You've gotten so furious that you just have to say something, like Jeff did. And I believe that we actually talked to Jeff, and Jeff was, I think, genuinely surprised we responded to Jeff. Jeff had really high... He really thought this show...
He thought we had office assistants and statisticians.
Yeah, we have a crew to do that.
Yeah.
Yes, we do. It's called us. We do the rowing around here, don't we, Tony?
Yeah,
So,
instant access.
So, facebook.com/HMRadioshow is where you'll find Health Matters and you'll find Jeff.
Fair enough. I'm not arguing. Our sponsor for today's show, Christmas Decorations, adding warmth and property damage to the holiday season. The Consumer Product Safety Commission estimates holiday decorating injuries injure more than 15,000 people.
And that's why I don't decorate my house. Exactly that, right?
One of the many reasons.
My kids never understood it, but that right there explains it.
Well, why don't you know, you could get that little spotlight thing now that just kind of makes snowflakes fly back and forth, and you're done. Just set it up. Start the wheel spinning and...
I don't like running the electricity out to it.
Problem solved.
I guess they're battery operated.
This was back from 2013. Fourth consecutive year, estimates have increased 250 injuries per day. Most frequently involved decorating incidents, falls 34%. Lacerations 11%, back strains 10%. Through 2009 through 2011, fire departments nationwide responded to an average of 200 fires in which the Christmas tree was the first item ignited. 10 deaths, 20 injuries, $16 million in property loss, candle-related fires, same years, 70 deaths, 600 injuries, $308 million in property loss. These are very significant problems that that we run into in the holiday season. We love it, but unfortunately, we're not very good at this. What do we do?
Well, you got your Christmas tree up?
I laugh at your... first of all, this show was pre-recorded. At least a couple hours before it airs.
We hope.
So way back then, I did not have a Christmas tree. Buying
not,
a live tree.
You're not going to have it up by the a few weekends from now?
No. I be honest with you, my family, we sometimes come in and travel. We may or may not have a tree. You know, we may just throw some lights on the dog.
Stay.
No pets.
Stay.
Let me just say, no pets were harmed. My wife is probably rolling over right now in her...
Oh, no, believe me, there are people coming to your door right now.
I know.
Because you can joke about a lot of things. You can't joke about Christmas.
If you are buying a live tree, though, A fresh tree is green. Its needles are hard to pull from branches. They don't break when bent.
You give a whole new meaning to live tree.
Bottom of a fresh tree is sticky with resin. So many comments. So little time. When tapped on the ground, the tree should not lose many needles.
Just like in that movie?
Like Rick. When tapped on the ground, should not be dropping
needles. Needles don't drop out of me.
When you're putting this tree up, don't put it next to fireplaces. I know it makes a nice picture. You put the tree next to the fireplace. Now, most people don't use their fireplaces, but if you have a fire in the fireplace and a tree next to it, well, then you need to rethink. You need to rethink a lot of things.
Yeah, I mean, there is a temperature level at which fire becomes fire.
Yeah,
and that's a similar temperature at which the tree becomes fire. And so they share temperature with one another, and it just this
somewhere between flammable and inflammable, that tree is going to catch fire. keep it away from vents and radiators. You really don't want this thing dried out. Don't block the doorway with a tree. Artificial tree, look for fire resistant. It doesn't mean it won't catch fire, but it does mean that it will be slow to catch fire.
Means you really got to try hard.
All right. Now here's I have some grandchildren. If you are decorating a tree in a home with small children, avoid putting sharp, weighted, or breakable decorations. And I just think across the tree because it's good odds that it might fall down.
But don't you really mean small kids or cats?
Yeah, cats are famous for this. We don't have indoor pets, but they're pretty bad. And the point is, you know, you can put them up high. That's one thing you could do, put the decorations up high. But if that tree gets pulled over, somebody's going to get hurt. We would rope ours to the – we had rafters in our living room. We'd just tie a rope up to the rafters so the thing could not fall. And then we would decorate the lower part with paper and plastic ornaments, and then we put the lights and stuff up high. It was pretty simple.
Why wouldn't you just hang the tree from the ceiling? Just don't even let it touch the ground.
Well, I mean, I would hoist it up, and then I would just kind of drop it into the tree stand. That was the easy way to do it back when
I was decorating. Don't even use the tree stand. Just let the thing dangle. It'd be great. You could have a tree swing in your house.
A dry tree swing.
Well, I mean, you already said it's not going to drop any needles.
If you keep it moist, if you give it water,
you spray it.
You can't mist it. No, you got to put it in a stand. You got to put it in a water source. They didn't even mention that because they figured that was common knowledge. Apparently, some people who, after they lose their interim title, they tend to forget these common sense things.
I have an artificial tree.
Hell, he's book smart, but he doesn't have any.
I have an artificial tree. I've had an artificial tree for quite some time. We used to get actual real trees, right, with the root ball still on it. And we did that for a few years when our kids were really small, and then we would take the tree out and plant it in the yard.
So. Never works.
Actually, I still got all the trees. Well, I got three of four, I think.
Better than me.
And one of them is like 27 foot tall. Of course, that daughter is 25 now, so it's had plenty of time to grow. So you don't do anything sentimental like that, do you?
Plastic trees, no.
No, I mean, you just cut the tree down and that's it.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's, you know, I mean, we live in a national forest. We live in an area that does a lot of timber work. There's nothing wrong with raising a tree and cutting it off and raising another tree. This would be like saying, well, I don't want to mow my grass because, you know, the little blades of grass need to grow for the environment. All right, first up then, in honor of Jeff, and we don't have a whole lot to say with Jeff. Jeff said, look, I don't have a certain disease. I'm just trying to get by. I like to listen to you. I'm up in Canada, and that's what we know about Jeff.
Oh, No. Come on, let's be honest. Jeff tried to goad me into making a joke about Alzheimer's.
Yeah, that's true.
And I made that mistake in year one, show number two, and I've never lived it down.
In your mind, I've forgotten it, but okay.
No, maybe you had forgot it.
What are you saying that I forgot it?
I forgot.
Yeah, I know. So you're going to make another joke about
No, you're making
you
the
think
joke.
I have.
You're making the joke. I'm telling you fact. I don't remember. No. No, he tried to goad us into a joke that got us in trouble. And so, yeah, of course.
All right.
I mean, I almost got fired over that. Yeah, I can't believe you don't remember this.
In honor of Jeff, we've got 12 famous Jeffs, and I'm going to try to get through them as quickly as possible. Jeffrey Rush is our number one Jeff. He is
spelled
Australian
similar,
actor.
Right?
Yeah, he is a Geoff. He was Captain Hector Barbossa in Pirates of the Caribbean. He also voiced Nigel the Pelican in Finding Nemo. He was the speech therapist in The King's Speech. He won awards for that and still active in acting and producing. Jeffrey Rush, our top famous Jeff. Number two, Geoffrey Chaucer. Most known for Canterbury Tales, but he did write in English in the 1300s when most formal writing was in Latin.
I vaguely remember him.
Jeff number three is Jeff Tate, American singer, musician in the 1980s with the metal band Queensryche.
He actually made your list?
Yeah, because he's one. He's number 14 it's on Queensryche. The Hit Parade's list of great metal vocalists of all time. Not that I'm a metal person. Not that I've ever listened.
Do you even know one song they sang?
Queensryche.
Right.
Not that I'm familiar with the...
I actually own their albums.
You
come
do?
On now.
Yes. You like it?
Well, I used to.
Okay, so you know Jeffrey Tate.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, not maybe you don't know him, but Jeff Tate. All right, here's one. Jeff Bodine.
No idea.
NASCAR driver. Oh, man, you just made a bunch of enemies. Lives in West Melbourne, Florida. A couple of things about Jeff Bodine you may not know. He as a young boy, he dressed up as a woman. I'm not making this up. He dressed up
and
as
I'm
a woman.
The one in trouble with fans?
Yeah, and he won a powder puff race because he wasn't allowed to compete with men. So he just he got in a powder
puff cheated.
Race. He cheated. He did, yeah.
So we're celebrating a cheater.
In 1978, won more races than any other modified driver in recorded history. 55 victories in 1 year. Guinness Book of World Records. Most wins in one season. Jeff Bodine. Jeff Lewis was American character actor. He was Clint Eastwood's sidekick in Any Which Way But Loose.
Okay. I know what you're talking about. Well, he did Any Which Way You Can.
Yeah, he did all
and
those.
And
then
Any Which Way But Loose.
Yeah. Jeff Sanderson. This is for you, Jeff. He's a Canadian, former professional ice hockey, left winger, Hartford Whalers, Columbus Blue Jackets, National Hockey League. I put a hockey player in for Jeff. Jeffrey Palmer, the fourth
is that Robert Palmer's
Labor
brother?
Government, 33rd Prime Minister of New Zealand.
Nope.
Jeffrey Marcy, an American astronomer, discovered more extrasolar planets than anyone else. He discovered 70 out of the first 100 extrasolar planets. And you know how I like physics and astronomy. Jeff Britton, rock drummer, worked with Paul McCartney.
So you got two musicians and only one actor.
Uh-huh. I edited this.
So where'd Jeff Bridges come out?
He's not a Geoff. He's just a regular Jeff.
Gotcha.
See, if I go with the J-E-F-Fs, then I got to include Jeff Dahmer, and I'm just not going to do that.
But he's Jeffrey.
I know. So I just wouldn't do it. Jeffrey Howe is the Margaret Thatcher's longest-serving cabinet minister. Jeff Rowley. A professional skateboarder, Skater of the Year from Thrasher Magazine. Jeffrey Edelston, he's a medical entrepreneur, and I really did like this. This guy was widely credited with starting the first locum service for providing fill-in physicians.
And do you want to explain what locum service is?
Yeah,
most people don't know that.
These are doctors who don't work full-time.
The rent-a-docs.
Yeah, it's a rent-a-doc. That's a good way of putting it. He also... started corporate medical practice and introduced extended hours medical centers to Australia. So those are our top 12 famous Jeffs in honor of Jeff. And Jeff, congratulations. You got a show because you hung around our Facebook page long enough.
And now we're going to promptly forget you.
Right. You too, during the break, get on the Facebook page, write something inane, and we will dedicate a show to you. We're coming back for our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Jeff Show. It's the Geoff Show. We are saluting our classy, north of the border Facebook friend, Jeff.
Our newfound friend.
That's right. Our sponsor for the second time, Christmas decorations, adding warmth and property damage to the holiday season. We talked about the injuries, 15,000 injuries during the holiday season. This is some old information, but we keep recycling it.
That's what
we
do.
Just like wrapping paper. It should be good year after year. Candles. Keep burning candles within sight. Do not burn a candle in a room where you aren't. And especially, they've got some really nice, realistic battery-powered candles now. You can get all that flickering stuff, a nice-looking flame, with much, much less risk.
Yeah, the bulb burns out, not burns down your house.
Yeah. Keep candles on a stable, heat-resistant surface. Don't put them where kids and pets can knock them over. And don't put them close to your Christmas tree, please, or your decorations. Lights. Usually, I think the number one recommendation I make on lights is use LED lights.
Of course.
Yeah, the old incandescent bulbs, yes, they're antiques. Yes, you've had them. It's Christmas tradition. Those things are hot. They're dangerous. They break. They short out. LED lights are much safer. And you can hook LED lights out to infinity, and you're not going to draw a whole lot of current. It is a wonderful thing.
Mm-hmm.
So LED lights, use those that have been tested at Underwriter Laboratories UL. Their green holographic signal signifies it meets their requirements. Check each set of lights to get rid of the ones with bare wires, even if that's your favorite set that you inherited from your grandmother. Check the extension cords. Please don't overload the extension cords. And check outdoor lights for labels. And it is best to have a ground fault.
Circuit interrupter.
Yeah, circuit interrupter on your outdoor lights.
GFCI.
Fireplaces, just a couple of things. They have fire salts that produce colored flames, but they do those salts. They have heavy metals. That's what makes the color, but that also makes those things very, very dangerous around kids. A kid takes those things, and they can kill.
Sure.
So you don't. They're very pretty. Kids put them in their mouths. Next thing they know, they're at the emergency room,
well,
getting their stomachs pumped. Yep. Don't burn wrapping paper in the fireplace.
Why do we not do that?
Well, certainly gets rid of it quickly.
Exactly why? What about your wood stove? You put it in the wood stove?
The problem is it's just too volatile. That stuff, you know, that thin tissue paper, you're going to put large amounts of it, and you're going to have just you want to shoot a flamethrower up your chimney. Yeah, it's just not a good idea. We'll have more holiday tips. That's our sponsor, Christmas Decorations, adding warmth and property damage to the holiday season. Now, this to me, I told Rick at the break, I was going to, we spent too much time on the Jeffs, and I was going to get rid of this, but then I just thought, I can't do this. This is Paul Sachs, is an editor of something called New England Journal of Medicine, Journal Watch, and he's an infectious disease guy. And he says, what about those in the buffet line, what about those food tongs? You know, the things that you use you pick your donut up with food tongs because you don't want to spread germs, right?
Do you actually use them?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I think it would be rude not to use the tongs. But he says, all right, I'm going to give you a scenario here. Imagine that I have a severe respiratory infection, snot pouring down my face. I'm sneezing. I'm wiping my nose. My hands are
laden
with germs.
Why are you out again?
Because I'm not going to let this cold get me down, and I go to the buffet.
You'd rather it get me down.
Right. Now, let's say there's a cookie there and there's some tongs. I got two options. One, I can take my snotty hands and pick up the cookie. I might get some germs on your cookie, but I'm going to pick it up with the cookie. Or the other thing is I can use the tongs that everyone else in line is going to use, and I can get my germs all over those tongs. What do you think for solid food? Not for Jell-O, but for solid food. What do you think is the safest way, the least infectious way, to get that food onto your plate?
Well, the problem is, Tony, is you set typically cookies are stacked in, and you can actually reach in and grab one, and you might graze or touch one around it. But what if the same guy with the same hand went into a thing of potato chips?
Right.
I mean, that's a whole different type of interaction. And so I don't know that you can necessarily, I think you kind of have to go tongs or no tongs every scenario. I mean, just, ugh.
Yeah. So he says.
But I do agree. I hear what you're saying, though. Yes. You don't want him to touch the tongs.
So
really, what you should put out some gloves.
Yeah, you could do that. Or the other thing, as far as potato chips, yeah, you need one of those big dispenser things like the dog food dispenser where you pull it down and it gives you a slug of potato chips.
Well, you realize the best way to do potato chips, right, is just give everybody their own really big bag, right?
I like the way you emphasize really big.
I mean, you don't want one of those little weenie bags, right? Those little bitty things.
Yeah,
you don't
sit
want
there,
them.
You're going to go after two or three.
Potato
you
chips.
Make sure people have potato chips.
Right.
I
that's
understand
like
what
giving
you're
somebody
saying.
A cup of popcorn. I need a large popcorn.
I need a bucket.
Somebody get me a bucket.
Bucket of popcorn. At any rate, we're talking about dry food items. He says bagels, cookies, slice of bread, and muffin, not potato chips. He didn't mention that. But I do think, you know, the thing that he really, the picture that they showed on this, it's a blog that he did, the picture they showed was a pair of tongs sitting next to some baked potatoes wrapped in aluminum foil. And at that point, very clearly, for something that is pre-wrapped, tongs, in fact, spread infection rather than prevent infection.
Sure.
There's no way around that. That's just simply silly. There was a they did a study, what's the safest way to pick up dry food? And again, after you read his article, it doesn't matter, said 51%. By hand, 40%, and tongs came in at a miserable 8%. But if there are tongs there, there is a lot of social pressure to use the tongs.
Well, of course. I mean, you know, should you just steer clear of it and not do either? You know, you don't go reaching with your hand, and you don't go using the tongs.
Eat before you come.
That's your, well, I know that's your, you do that with like church potlucks, right?
Yeah, yeah. So you show up, you shake everybody's hand, but you don't touch the food.
You're such a crowd pleaser.
I just remind you of last year about this time, because I went back and looked. We brought in the Killer Buffet article.
Of course.
Where the woman had made some potato salad out of potatoes that were undercooked.
And it was a church potluck,
canned
I remember.
It, using improper practices, got them out, didn't warm them up, made potato salad, brought there, and there were deaths. There were deaths from her potato salad. So,
you know, Tony, I would never joke about wishing that upon, you know, you, for instance, but I'm fighting it. I'm fighting the urge.
We're all interim in this life, Rick. And you never know what's going
to
happen.
So what's right? What's the right thing to do here? I mean, do you tongs? Do you hands? Do you? I mean,
you know, almost got to follow social convention because you know how upset I get when somebody tries to shake my hand at the dinner table.
You are not a handshaker at all.
Well,
much less at the dinner table.
I'm not. You're right. I don't like shaking hands anyway, but especially at the dinner table, you have no options. You shake that guy's hand, then you got to get up from the table and go clean your hands. That's the only option you got.
I wish you would have went to Ethiopia with me so that you could have started off every meal with a kiss on each cheek.
Hershey's?
Over there, you greet, you basically hug and kiss on each cheek, and then you sit down and eat. With your hands,
I understand, but honestly, I think unless we've got shared things, a kiss on the cheek is less infectious than people who shake my hand and then I'm eating with my hand.
Yeah, but so now, basically, so what we're saying is anytime you see Tony out at lunch, don't shake his hand, offer him a kiss on the cheek. Is that what we're saying?
Come over, shake my hand, and make me just...
Get up and go to the bathroom.
Spaz out. Yeah, that's what I do. Okay.
Are you a germaphobe?
No. Actually, no. I mean, it's
so you really
like
probably
it.
Wouldn't go to the bathroom. And
no, I wouldn't. I just go. Well, that really sucks, and then I just start eating. You know, because again, if you're around dogs and horses and cows and stuff like that, you really can't afford to get too uptight about what happens because a lot of stuff happens.
Right.
So, all right. Next up, this came from Politico, which I don't know why it came from Politico, which is Politico.com. This was a story about a hospital without patients, and I wanted to get our radio fans. I'm going to run a series of articles here that makes you kind of think about what healthcare might be. Mercy Virtual is the name. It is a hospital. It has nurses, doctors, cafeteria. Staff are looking after very sick people. The one thing it doesn't have, it has no beds, and it has no patients. This is a virtual hospital. They have... They basically sit in front of a bank of screens, camera's eye views of patients, their rooms, graphs of their blood chemicals, images of their lungs and limbs, list of problems that the computer programs tell them to look out for. The nurses do wear scrubs, but the scrubs are extremely clean. There's nothing on them. They basically, you know, it's a very quiet place where they're watching these people on monitors. And the idea then that there are sort of two wings to this building here. One of them is home monitors, and they monitor the patients at home. Again, they have people get on their laptops. They chat. They also have access to vital signs and things like that, and try to keep people out of the hospital who have chronic illnesses. But the other people, they're actually watching in the ICU. And for some hospitals that may be a little bit short nursing staffing or hospitals that don't have ICU critical care specialists, these people will supplement what you're doing. They will keep an eye on your patients when you may not have the staffing or the specialist to do so. And by this continuous monitoring that they do, they feel they can find a problem with your patient before you are able to do so. A nurse checks vital signs a couple of times a shift. They are monitoring vital signs constantly. Their computers will tell them the trends on the vital signs. So they will see that heart rate go up maybe 2-3 hours before a nurse visiting would recheck the pulse, even if they did recognize the heart rate was higher.
It's an interesting concept. I mean, you know, really this sounds to me like really just a different way of doing like staff augmentation, right? So you have, you know, more staff watching more screens. They just don't happen to be in the place where you're at, right?
Yeah, that's true. And they, but and the thing is, the amount of equipment they have supposedly makes up. I talked to this about. I talked to the students about this. I was talking to some of our PA students, and I said, you know, I said, this is a pretty interesting idea. They said, yeah, but you know, you can't touch the patient. You can't feel whether their belly's tender, for instance. On the other hand, if you could see that their pulse jumped 4 hours before their belly even got tender, then that would give you an advantage in their medical care. Financially, it's in the black. Their claim is, and I don't know if this is true or not, their claim is that by doing this continuous monitoring, they're able to save money, get people out of the hospital earlier, prevent complications, or on their home monitoring end, they keep people with chronic illnesses who are very ill from having to come into the emergency room by heading off problems early.
I mean, Tony, this is classic, you know, we're going to solve more problems with big data, right? So, I mean, we talk about big data, and most people think, okay, well, that's, you know, some kind of IBM Watson or some kind of massive thing. But really what this is you're just able to make better decisions because the data is being interrogated and monitored more.
Right.
I mean, you know, if you're going to check your vitals or check the stuff twice a shift, you know, that's, while that may be good, it wouldn't be better if you had it checked every 20 minutes and, you know, over the course of an 8-hour shift. There are trends and things that happen with patients that, again, an 8-hour, you know, two times an 8 hours, so every 4 hours, you're just not going to have the same granularity on the data. The more data you have, the better data it is, equals, you know, better decisions. I mean, it makes sense. I can see where this is going. You know, it won't be long before we're all just big walking data, either generators or repositories.
Yeah. And two things about that. One is I just read, and I did not bring it to this show, we use Watson kind of as the prototype for big data, but the article I read said that Watson is losing ground. Basically, IBM is not really you think of Watson as the world's premier big data computer, but there are others that are actually doing more than Watson is. So I think Watson's going to be an historical oddity in a few years, but not necessarily the face of...
Well, but let's be honest. I mean, every big data system is going to be referred by laypersons as a Watson.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's just what we've done over the years. I mean, you know, Bovie was for electrosurgical generators and, you know, everybody...
Frigidaire.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, so maybe there'll be a Watson. I see that. But the other side of it is, you know, if you expect every nurse who is trained in human contact or every doctor who goes to a medical school to understand big data and how to analyze it. We've said this before on this show. I don't know what to do if you unloaded a month's worth of Fitbit data on me. I don't know what to make of that. But if you put somebody in a specialized center and someone who had familiarity with this and you kind of aggregated your big data specialty, then perhaps they could serve as a big data consultant virtually.
Correct.
In my hospital, and that way I would not have to teach all of my nurses all across the country how to monitor big data. And the other thing is, none of them is going to, they're so busy passing medicines, they're so busy answering phone calls or doing other things, talking to the patient's family, that they are not going to be able to analyze the numbers like somebody who is sitting there with a computer screen and a lot of computing horsepower.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Again, it's just the ability to take the data and turn it into a good decision, and that, unfortunately, just takes time and energy. And in a hospital environment, there's so much more to do. So it's just, I mean, it's hard. I can see where this makes sense.
Right.
I can see where it's an evolutionary step in healthcare.
Well, let me follow that up, because this was in the November 27th Journal of the American Medical Association. They said, is it time for a new medical specialty? They called them the medical virtualist.
But Tony, we already have those. I mean, every time... how many years ago did we go through this where you pick up the telephone in the middle of the night, you take up your iPad, and you get virtual help because you got a headache? Or, you know, your insurance carrier is showing you how to get help. We already have virtual. Anyway.
All right. So Rick says we don't need it. I'm going to go ahead and read. Their background is, well, look, after we refined ventilators, breathing machines, cardiac monitoring, anesthesia, surgical advancements, we developed critical care specialists with then neurological intensive specialists, laparoscopic and robotic surgical equipment led to new subspecialty categories in colon and rectal surgery. interventional radiology and electrophysiology, again, new specialties. And in non-procedural areas, we tried geriatrics, and we've done palliative care now, laborist, intensivist, hospitalist, and so forth, people within a setting. Now, the idea is to develop people with good, and they use this term, which I hate, webside manner.
Right.
People... and the difference, I mean, I understand the when you're talking about telemedicine or you're talking about the guy that you call in the middle of the night.
Now, understand, that's usually family practice. And so right. what you're seeing is what's proven to be effective in family practice is now finding its way into the subspecialties.
Sure. But they were one-on-one. They were still doctors who just used the telemedicine or the virtual visit. What if you had the people that not only used this the virtual encounters, but also knew what to make of the reams of data you can get from monitoring. At that point, you have a new specialty, one that is not driven based on physical examination and talking to your family, but one that is based on data analysis and being able to obtain cues and clues through video conferencing.
Absolutely.
It is an entirely different specialty and something that may, in fact, take root.
No, I mean, I can't imagine that it wouldn't. And here's the other thing that it does. Okay, so for maybe for internal medicine or for pick one of the common, specialties, there's probably enough volume that, you can do some of this locally. But what about the really, really odd cases? They're scattered throughout the region or the U.S. Now, all of a sudden, you can take a specialist that's got specific data that's in, very difficult for them to go see in person. And now you can aggregate that data, move it to a place where they can virtually analyze it and deal with it and actually help, 50 patients across the U.S. as opposed to 10 patients if they had to travel or the patients had to travel to see them. So right. So it does actually kind of centralize the services.
Right. And you could then augment the ability of a small rural hospital.
Absolutely.
With both live people who are good at talking to you and your family and then the virtual people who are good at data interpretation. I see with these virtual hospitals and with the idea of a virtualist, you can see an evolution of medicine. You can see a change in the way medical care will be delivered. And we at Health Matters, these are the sort of things that we like to inform you about.
And you know, Tony, that we're going to at some point going to be a virtual radio show.
We're going to inform you now about a break we're going to take, and we're going to come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of the Jeff Show. I'm Rick Phillips.
I thought I was supposed to introduce the show.
You can do it all you want.
The show. I'm Dr. Tony Weaver, and this is the Jeff Show.
I'm going to get rid of my interim status one of these days.
Just jump the gun. Introduce the show. That's not in your contract.
Hey, look, any show that we have that's got one word name, I can do.
That's right. It is the Geoff Show. Again, named after our new friend from Canada, Geoff, who was kind enough to hit us up on our Facebook page. Why don't you do that, and you can get your own radio show as well. Our sponsor for the final time, Christmas decorations, adding warmth and property damage to the holiday season. And again, we'll go back to our first point. 15,000 injuries involving holiday decorating seen in emergency departments during November and December. That is an average, and it's a few years old, but it's going to be that much now. We have not made any major changes in ladder safety or abrasion avoidance that would change that. 250 injuries per day, a third of them falls, 11% lacerations, 10% back strains from trying to get these things up and down the stairs. We talked about the tree. Please do not put it next to the fireplace. Please, if you're having a live tree, check for freshness. If you're having an artificial tree, check to make sure that it is fire resistant. If you're decorating in a home with small children or pets, keep the sharp ornaments away. Anchor that tree firmly or just don't use your glass ornaments. Make it so that if it fell over, it would be funny rather than being dangerous. Candles, keep them within sight. Keep them on a stable surface. Lights, go to the LED lights. Check each set. Look at the extension cord. Check outdoor lights for labels. Fireplaces, don't burn wrapping paper. And make sure you keep your fire salts safe. They're colorful. They look like candy. They contain heavy metals. They could kill a small child. This one is one of my favorite. It came out a couple years ago. Dr. Carlos Roldan. He's a Texas ER doc and spokesman for the American College of Emergency Physicians at the time. He describes DUI, decorating under the influence. Consumer Product Safety Commission, again, talks about the 15,000 injuries and the candles and so forth. Here's a couple of tips. The three worst days for candle fires nationwide, Christmas Eve, Christmas Day, and New Year's Day. Consumer Product Safety Commission reminds people they should get rid of holiday lights that have damage like broken sockets and bare wires. Oh, my goodness. Yes. That's ridiculous. And make sure that it meets Underwriter Laboratories or the Canadian Standards Association. Don't forget our friends up north. Extension cords, not frayed, not broken, used for its intended outdoor-indoor use. Don't take an indoor extension cord outdoors. If you've got lights outdoors, GFCI-protected receptacle. And you can buy a little thing that plugs into your plug and converts. So, you know, if you don't have a – you should have a GFCI outdoor plug anyway. If you don't, for purposes of holiday decorating – you can get an extension that does that.
So, Tony, you know why we use a GFCI, right?
I am in no way going to talk in front of a guy like you about electricity.
Oh, come on. Come on.
Take it away, Rick.
Tell me what the GFCI. Why do we even want it?
Why don't you tell me how you treat hypertension then, you big bozo? Who got real there for a minute? We're back.
You want to take a second to compose yourself?
Yeah, I lost it. I'm sorry. Right on the air. No, but talk about it, Rick, because you know this better than I.
Well, I mean, a ground fault circuit interrupter. Basically, it checks the ground, and if it sees that the ground has been lost, it trips the breaker, and essentially it will not work, right? And so it's there to protect you. If it sees current leaking across, you know, onto the ground, it basically trips. And so It's there to protect you. It's to make sure that whatever you're doing has a proper ground.
Now here, this shows how dated these recommendations are. No more than three standard size light sets per single extension cord. With LEDs, that rule no longer applies.
Yeah, well, I mean, LEDs are low current. They're low heat. I mean, there's nothing really at this point bad about LEDs other than the cost.
Yep. Keep candles within sight on a stable surface, at least 3 feet away from the tree or wrapping paper. Live trees, watered frequently. Artificial trees, make sure they're fire resistant. Never burn wrapping paper in the fireplace. Never burn wrapping paper in the fireplace. That is our sponsor, Christmas decorations, adding warmth and property damage to the holiday season. Now, I'm going to keep on with this virtual thing. So we've talked about the virtual hospital, the idea that you could have additional monitoring being done at a distance. And these virtual hospitals have the computing horsepower to feed in continuous feeds of your vital signs, your laboratory tests, and so forth. And they have specialists who look at that data, and they learn to master that data. And they had one arm that was an outpatient area for people who are chronically ill and homebound, so that they could get care when they needed it without having to hop in an ambulance. I tell you, you know, I do house calls. You knew that.
Right.
For palliative care. We ran into a situation. We'd seen the person. He seemed like he was doing okay. We made some minor suggestions about his care. We went outside. His wife came outside. She said, "We're getting the house sprayed for bed bugs. What are we going to do with him? He is bedbound. He is effectively unable to walk. So what do you do with a person who's effectively unable to walk when you get your house sprayed? Who do you call, and where does he go?" And this is like the second week of December. It's going to be cold, might be wet. What are you going to do? And we're checking on it, trying to figure this out. If anybody has an answer, please hit us on Facebook and tell me. But it's to move him, with him being bedbound, to move him safely would require an ambulance.
Right.
So the ambulance gets him, takes him for a joyride, and then deposits him back at his own house after the danger from the bed bug treatment is gone.
But that's going to take a while because I'm sure the fumes and everything have to dissipate.
Yeah. So it's those kind of things. A virtual hospital, they can't fix that problem, but they can at least keep them from having to come in an ambulance for a routine medical care.
Right.
And then on the other end, for intensive care patients that are kept in community hospitals and suburban hospitals that may not have intensivist specialists that do these things, they can provide additional brain power and also additional monitoring capability. This is a marvelous thing. That then will lead, we believe, to the rise of the virtualist, the person that understands how to interpret this data. I will tell you right now, I don't. If you brought your Fitbit, whatever your monitor is, and you showed me that your pulse had jumped by 10 over the past week, I would start by asking you if you have any fever or if anything hurts, and I would do an exam just like I would for anything else. I don't know what to do with that data, and there has not been anything written in textbooks. What is the diagnosis? What are the diagnostic possibilities of a change in your data? It's just, you know, the first thing that has to happen is a symptom or something visible different about you.
Right.
If you have a change in a mole or if you have a pain in your knee, I can handle that. If your data changes, I don't know what to do with that unless you have a mole or a pain in your knee.
Yeah, you still need to, you know, to me, I would think you'd want to do some kind of a comparison study with a, you know, a different, obviously the tools available to you as a physician are a little bit more robust and a little more accurate. Be curious to see if it really, you know, a raise of 10, you know, that's probably going to be hard to detect.
Yeah.
It'd be more like a raise of 50.
Well, and the thing is, you know, the way we do it with intermittent vital signs,
right,
and not graphing them, we would not be able to notice that it was consistently elevated,
right,
which can be a problem. I there's a part of me that just is annoyed by this. You know, look, I am there with the patient. I am talking with their family. You are on a TV screen. You're 300, 400 miles away. I don't need your help, you big technological annoyance.
So you're the proverbial woolly mammoth, and you're looking up as it's starting to snow.
See, I don't understand that analogy, but also
you're about to go extinct if you don't change your ways.
Well, I think if it starts to snow, the woolly mammoth is probably in pretty good shape there, Rick.
How'd that fare? How'd the woolly mammoth fare in that?
Better than the,
I think I've got history
better
on my
than the
side,
bald
Tony.
Mammoth, I'll put it that way.
I've got history on my side. I don't think they made it through that snowstorm.
By the way, that would be a great name for a sports team, the Woolly Mammoths. I know that I'm just kind of, but there you go. But no, I understand. So you're saying, well, and time will probably prove that to be an outdated idea, and it really doesn't matter whether I'm wrong or right. I mean, I think this is going to carry the day,
right? And since I have started down the IT path, right, there's never been a year where change wasn't imminent.
Yeah,
I mean, it's constant change, you know. And so you have to either be able to adapt and deal with it, or eventually you find yourself at the back of the line. And so again, I say, is some of this stuff solid? Well, not yet, but there's some things that are coming that we've got to figure out how to let other people monitor the data. We've got to figure out how to get a set of trained eyes to look for certain patterns and certain things that give us clues to make the right decisions.
Well, we're going to – and we need that – to start off with, that needs to be concentrated. We've obviously got to accumulate more experience with this, and that's where
and more
a
data.
Virtualist in a virtual hospital might be able to make a case. I'm, you know, no, it's not ready yet. No, they're not better yet, but they're going to be better.
But you know what they are doing is they're tracking both the data and the outcomes. And at some point, they will correlate the two, and they'll be able to look at the data and correlate it to an outcome. And then when they see the trends in the data, they'll know how to make – what do they need to do to get to the right outcome.
Now, let me show you something – or let me tell you – obviously, I can't show you much on the radio. Wait, let me tell you something else.
You can show me.
I know, but then – and you can be impressed, but then they'll just have to listen to you being impressed.
I
and
probably
that's
won't
no fun.
Be, though.
This was from the AMA Journal of Dermatology, and again, reported in early November. They talked about smartphone cameras, and I got to tell you, I've already done this on a number of occasions, but they were looking at taking photographs of a skin condition, sending that to a dermatologist for diagnosis. Now let me explain this. When you go to the hospital, they will take an x-ray picture of your chest, a chest x-ray. They will send it to an expert for interpretation.
Sure.
Now, they should accompany that with some story about what symptoms you're having and so forth so that they'll be able to do the interpretation. But they are able to look at that picture and to add value to your care. If you get if you have a problem with your heart, they will take an EKG and they will print that on a piece of paper or do it electronically and send it to a person to look at. Our problem right now is we, especially those who don't have a lot of money are critically short of dermatologists.
Mm-hmm.
Dermatologists, they make a lot of money. They work very good hours.
Very regionalized.
Yes, and they tend to remain in suburban and large metropolitan areas. They do not come out to rural
areas. And aren't they
typically,
most of the time they're a fee-for-service. They're kind of outside of a traditional insurance plan.
Yeah. So Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, published in AMA Journal of Dermatology, between March and September 2016, they sent photography instruction sheets to 20 families. The other 20 had no instructions. Lots of ethnicities, lots of different skin colors in this. Apple iPhones, Android phones in use. And they compared diagnosis made with an in-person examination with taking a photograph on your phone. 87 images submitted. 83% of the time, the diagnosis agreed. Now, there were some images that were too blurry, and when they eliminated those, the agreement went up to 89% agreement. So when you think about diagnosing dermatologic conditions in an era when there's a great shortage of dermatologists, you don't need to have everybody clogging their office. If they could run through these photographs and stories and give you a likely diagnosis, and dermatologists are very used to dealing with photographs. They take their board exams based on photographs. Then these type of things would carry the same weight as a chest X-ray or an EKG. You get a photograph of a rash, and you get an interpretation from a specialist. And we could magnify the power of our dermatologists and help our primary care providers provide better care to their patients with rashes.
Yeah, I don't know. The dermatology thing has always been kind of tough. I mean, back when, you know, when I was knee-deep in telemedicine, dermatology was just a classic candidate for telemedicine. Now, what we found out was you didn't need full motion video, right? You really just needed good, high quality stills. And you know, I was even involved with some folks who tried to do the right color balance, trying to make sure the proper skin tones are being matched. And you know, I think when we got down to it, I think really just a basic cell phone camera that's of today's quality is actually producing images good enough to basically see. You know, the dermatologist or the specialist can see what they want to see and make the correct diagnosis. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, and for something like that, you really don't need to wait in somebody's office.
No.
You do not need to drive.
It can be what we call asymmetric, right? And we send the image off, we wait some time, we get the response back. There's no reason that it has to be symmetric, which is a sitting there in the office, I show you, you talk to me.
Yeah.
You know, that's you know.
You could do that in your spare time. And suddenly then healthcare becomes more convenient. We also make better use of our specialists. The dermatologist does not need to take a complete history and physical.
Well,
if you have a family doctor who can do that.
And who says the dermatologist has to be in your town?
Yeah.
It could be in Canada. Could be in Australia. Could be, you know, your healthcare could follow the sun, right? So wherever the sun is lighting up the earth, that's where your healthcare could be provisioned from.
Now,
so nobody's ever getting woke up and on call.
Yeah, this is what Rick's talking about. We've already experimented with this on radiology.
Correct.
Now, there are issues with licensing. Obviously, your doctor is licensed in your home state, but you can work out arrangements to do this. And so there are some radiology groups in particular that have around the world affiliates who can do night readings, basically for each other.
Stay for them, it's night for us.
Yeah,
but again, it's a follow-the-sun methodology, right? So wherever the sun's up is a working day shift for that crew, it's actually easier for them to see these types of patients than it would be for us to wake somebody up in the middle of the night, bring them in and do it.
And so I want to give you the idea of what this could add to our healthcare. And you can see it could add a lot of convenience and a lot of value. You get access to the expertise you need without doing the travel.
Could actually reduce costs, too.
Yeah, I wish. You know,
could.
This has been problematic. We've not been able to get that done, but still.
Well, and I think some of that, Tony, lies in what you said. I mean, you know, we have state. There's still the regulations and the rules are still behind the technology, right? We can up. The technology moves fast. Things, I mean, how long, I mean, just think about it. Uber's what, 2 years old? 2.5, 3 years old, maybe tops? I mean, it's probably a little older than that, but I mean, it's really been popular for 2 years. Airbnb, you start looking at all these hugely successful products that have come out that have just exploded. The regulations can't keep up with it. And so we got to figure out how to get our government and our social protections to keep pace with what's coming out.
Yeah.
And that's the real problem, I think.
Yeah. Well, the payment system doesn't allow for this kind of stuff.
No.
And that has been the single biggest roadblock right now. It could be done. It could be done safely. It could be done efficiently. There would be people willing to do it, and yet we're blocking the payment systems.
Yeah, we just can't do it for free.
Yeah.
So, is that what you were hoping to get out of that whole thing?
Well, I'm hoping that Jeff liked it. I mean, because Jeff talked about he just wants to be able to live. He doesn't have a certain disease. He wanted to be able to live longer. And I just thought, Jeff, how about some medicine?
He got his 1 hour of fame.
And it's time to go.
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and to Eric Bilber, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans, even you, Jeff. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these words adapted from an editorial in the Annals of Internal Medicine on vitamins in 2013.
After reviewing 3 trials of multiple radio shows and 24 trials of single radio shows affecting more than 400,000 participants, researchers have concluded that there is no clear evidence that Health Matters has a beneficial effect on mortality, heart disease, or cancer.
A second trial evaluated the effectiveness of daily Health Matters to protect brain health among 6,000 men over 65. After 12 years of follow-up, there were no differences between the Health Matters and the placebo groups.
Despite clear evidence of no benefit or possible harm from our show, use of Health Matters supplements has increased among U.S. adults from 30% in 1990 to 40% in 2005.
The evidence is now sufficient to advise against routine listening to Health Matters, and we should translate this evidence into action.
The message is simple. Like most supplements, Health Matters does not prevent chronic disease or death. It should be avoided. This message is especially true for general population with no evidence of nutritional deficiency. Enough is enough.
Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life. Ignore the warnings and tune in next week for more life-saving episodes of Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Bye, Jeff.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.